طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine. My name is Salma Abu Ayyash. This Week in Palestine is a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This program was also created by late Sharif Fahm, and it's in his honor and dear memory that we try to continue his work. Today is Sunday, March 27, and we have the pleasure of having with us Dr. Mazen Qomsiyah on the phone from Boston. Dr. Qomsiyah is on a tour promoting his much-anticipated book, Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment. He spoke last night at the Palestinian Cultural Center for Peace in Alston and will be giving two more talks later on in the week, so stay tuned for details of when and where. Dr. Qomsiyah teaches and does research at Bethlehem and Birzeit universities in occupied Palestine. He previously served on the faculties of the University of Tennessee, Duke, and Yale universities. He served on the board and steering executive committees of a number of groups, including Peace Action Education Fund, the U.S. Campaign to End the Occupation, the Palestinian American Congress, Association for One Democratic State in Israel-Palestine, and BoycottIsraeliGoods.org. He is now president of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People and coordinator of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements in Beit Sahur. He advised many other groups, including Somerville Divestment Project, which happened right here in Massachusetts, Olympia Rafah Sister City Project, Palestine Freedom Project, Sabil North America, and National Council of Churches of Christ USA. He is an active member of a number of human rights groups, including Amnesty, Peace Action, Human Rights Watch, ACLU, etc. He published several books, the most acclaimed of which is Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle, which was also translated to Spanish. He also has an activism book published electronically on his website, Qomsiyah.org, Qumsiyah.org. His main interest is media activism and public education. He published over 200 letters to the editor, 100 op-ed pieces, and interviewed in TV and radio extensively, local and international, with many appearances on Boston Globe, CNBC, C-SPAN. He also regularly lectures on issues of human rights and international law. Most importantly, for me and many Palestine activists, he is our eyes and ears on the ground. He's an inspiration and a source of hope for us as one of the many steadfast leaders of Palestinian resistance. Today we will focus on Dr. Mazen's newest book, Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment. Dr. Qomsiyah, welcome to This Week in Palestine, and thank you for being with us this early in the morning.
Thank you very much for this very generous introduction. And certainly for having me on your beautiful show.
Thanks. You are most welcome. The title of your book, again, is Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment. First of all, maybe you should define to our listeners what you mean by popular resistance.
Well, popular resistance is the forms of resistance that most people engage in when they are subjected to colonial settler occupation, which is what we have in Palestine. International law says that people have a right, of course, to resist colonial occupation by any means that they choose. And Palestinians, of course, the majority of them, chose to resist by the means that are listed in Gene Sharp's book about resistance, where he says there are 199 forms.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why he couldn't come up with one more.
But
basically, they involve everything from civil disobedience to boycotts to demonstrations, petitions, all sorts of things that are short of the armed resistance of shooting at your opponent. So basically, this is the kind of nonviolent resistance that we engage in. Of course, we also, as Palestinians, resist by simply staying on our land, because the Zionist movement wanted Palestine to be transformed from multi-ethnic, multicultural society
mm-hmm.
to a Jewish state. And for us, staying in our land, getting married, having breakfast, eating, living, are all forms of nonviolent or popular resistance.
I see. So Palestinians, as you said, certainly have the right to resist in any way available to them while respecting human rights and the sanctity of life of non-combatants. And universal rights to carry arm to resist an occupation was drafted in response and in solidarity to uprisings of people against the Nazi occupation. For example, the Warsaw Armed Uprising of 43 was the first armed revolt in Europe against the Nazis. I am curious, how come, despite the horrific lives that Palestinians endure and the racist colonial project of Israel, Palestinians are denied the right to resist in this fashion or just are scorned upon by some activists? I understand that popular resistance is not exclusive of anything, but we wish that we adopt a nonviolent form, but there are some who don't. And what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, generally in the West, they say, well, why don't Palestinians do nonviolent resistance? This is a rather simplistic attitude from some people, some well-meaning, but many also who are not well-meaning, mm-hmm. Who are trying to impose on the Palestinians certain ideas. But any historian or even any rational human being, if we look at the history of anti-colonial struggle, we see that there is no anti-colonial struggle that involved all nonviolent resistance, mm-hmm. or for that matter, all violent resistance. There's always a mix on the ground that's natural in these situations, and so Palestinians are certainly no exception, whether the struggle in India against the British or the whites in South Africa and the black population that struggled against apartheid laws or French in Algeria, or even here in the U.S., the civil rights movement, there was certainly violence. Violence always is a small, very tiny component of the struggle, and this is the same in Palestine. 99.99% of Palestinians mm-hmm. certainly resist by nonviolent methods.
Yet the Western media and its racism focuses on the exceptions, the suicide bombers and the Hamas rockets. What can you tell us about this bias and misrepresentation?
Well, in many ways, I mean, it's understandable from the concept of the colonizers. When the white Europeans settled in North and South America, for example, to justify what they were doing, they would describe the natives as violent, as savages, etc. This is natural in colonial societies to describe natives as somehow unworthy human beings mm-hmm. and as violent human beings. But the actuality of it, of course, there was some violence among Native Americans towards whites. But it is a small component of what these people have engaged mm-hmm. in. And more importantly, people forget the violence of the colonizers'
exactly.
occupiers against the colonized occupied, which is usually 10 or 100-fold, sometimes more. For example, in South Africa under apartheid, the ratio of black civilians killed to white civilians killed was 10 to 1. Mm-hmm. And in Palestine, the ratio is similar. Also, 10 Palestinians are killed for every Israeli who's killed. This is the violence that we should focus on, the violence of the occupiers or colonized against the occupied colonized people.
And certainly the machinery of the colonizer being the fourth largest army in the world and the sophistication of targeting Palestinians in this oppressive way is something to point out.
Yeah, I was going to comment on this also.
Yeah, go ahead.
Part of the reason why you get this distorted percentage is because the available tools of killing to the occupiers and technology of the occupiers. For example, just 2 years ago in Gaza, over a three-week period, Israel butchered 1,400 Palestinians. Most of them were civilians. In the same time period, 3 weeks, there were 13 Israelis who were killed. Most of them were soldiers.
And most by friendly fire, by the way.
Yeah, and so if we look at the ratio, it's more than 100 to 1.
Yes. So you mentioned the colonizers' distortions, and we call it in Israel, for Israel, the Hasbara, their campaign of distorting the facts in the Western media. It has succeeded for a long time, as we said, to stereotype Palestinians as violent and to delegitimize our struggle. However, I have to say we're witnessing a shift in the recent past. What do you attribute that to? What has been the role of the internet, for example, in bringing to the surface the truth about the nature of Israeli occupation and colonization?
Yes, indeed. We are lucky that we live in a period in history when those who control the mainstream media are facing an obstacle, the obstacle being that that the internet is allowing us to exchange information on an unprecedented scale among common human beings, people who care about this issue, and also to find out what is really going on in the ground. These days, when an event happens, whether in Tunisia or Algeria or Libya or Egypt, as we saw recently, within 20 minutes, 10 minutes, videos are circulating on the internet showing what is really going on the ground. So I think it is very, very hard for colonial occupiers to do what they did, let's say, 200 years ago, when they just simply described the natives as savages and everybody, well, you know, if that's what they say, they are savages, they are savages. Well, show me the video and let's look at what really happened. What really happened was the colonizers were the ones who were truly savages in their oppression of the native people. Mm-hmm. And this is now becoming more and more obvious.
We promised our listeners to talk about your book. And it's certainly a great resource for anyone interested in any kind of popular resistance and in Palestine, Israel. It's an anthology of Palestinian popular resistance going back to the beginning of the Zionist project in the 19th century until today. I know we don't have a lot of time, and this is the gist of your recent work, but can you give our audiences, our listeners, perhaps a summary of the various epochs of a Palestinian popular resistance, which goes way back to the latest attention given to us by some Western media?
Yes, I found in my research for this book that basically over the past 130 years, mm-hmm. We have had over 15 nonviolent we have had over 15 nonviolent uprisings mm-hmm. in Palestine from the first uprising, which was in the 1880s, mm-hmm. until today, under the Ottoman Empire, the British Empire, and later, of course, under Israeli Zionist colonization in Palestine. Mm-hmm. And in these uprisings, which come as waves and come and go, basically, we find that people accomplish a lot, and the biggest accomplishment for us has been to remain on our land. 5.5 million Palestinians who still live between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean, despite a very determined, highly funded, well-supported by Western project, Western support, a project of ethnic cleansing and destruction of life that has transpired. Mm-hmm. And this is itself is inspiring. That's why the subtitle of the book is A History of Hope and Empowerment. So I think this is what the lessons that I learned is that there has been significant successes despite sometimes our own human frailty of focusing on the negatives. There's a lot of positives. Mm-hmm. Even just the last few years, for example, this apartheid wall that Israel is building on Palestinian land in the West Bank, this wall was slated to cost $2.5 billion and to be finished in 4 years. Instead, it's already more than 8 years. The wall is not even 70% finished, and it had cost $8 billion. Mm-hmm. This is nothing short of a miracle of popular resistance that's causing this kind of change.
Yes, and we may add here that the wall was supposedly erected to stop, quote-unquote, violence and suicide bombings from happening in Israel proper. And yet, you know, the wall is unfinished, and people who want to do this can do it if they want it. And it's clear that from previous presentations that I attended, that you have given, and many other things that I've read, that this is a land grab, and this is a wall that's created to confine Palestinian communities in ghettos and to turn their life miserable and not give them access to the land, etc. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what you witness of the wall.
Well, I mean, I myself, as a Palestinian Christian from the Bethlehem area, I'm not allowed even to go to Jerusalem by Israeli apartheid laws, and Jerusalem is only 6 miles away from me. Mm-hmm. And yet I and many, many thousands of Palestinians do go to Jerusalem. Of course, when there's a will, there is a way. And as I said, the wall is not finished. And even when it is finished, it will not stop Palestinians. Mm-hmm. We saw that the wall in Gaza is finished, and yet Gazans do still go back and forth through tunnels or some other way to get food from outside to the besieged Gaza Strip. So if I can certainly enter Jerusalem without a permit several times, then certainly anybody can. And so this, as you pointed out, has nothing to do with security. It has everything to do with disruption of normal life and normal commerce between people, between Palestinians in East Jerusalem, for example, and Palestinians in Bethlehem. The other thing we have to realize is that Palestinians exist on both sides of the wall, and Israelis exist on both sides of the wall. There are settlements on the so-called Palestinian side of the wall. And certainly if a Palestinian wants to do harm to Israelis, they could do it to the settlers who are living among us, for example, at the edge of Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. So again, you know, this notion that the wall is about security has been proven false for a long time. And we Palestinians will not accept this propaganda, and as we also mentioned earlier, the internet is now helping us debunk a lot of these mythologies upon which colonial settler Zionism is built.
So focusing on some of the villages that and Beit Sahur, including the village, the town where you're from, Bil'in and Al'in, Beit Umar, where I'm proud to say that I'm from, and others where movement of popular resistance have been created to resist this colonization apparatus, which is the apartheid wall, basically, and confiscations of lands and harassments of Palestinians, etc. One village that has become the focus of a lot of the Western population is the village of Budrus, and this is due to the film Budrus, which is about one man's story of resistance and his daughter and how they managed to change the path of the apartheid wall. Tell us a little bit about Budrus and the village of Budrus and the film, which got a lot of acclaim, and yet, you know, a lot of us have some criticism of the film, especially, I'll let you talk about it, I guess.
I mean, I personally know the story of Budrus very well, and unfortunately the film is not telling the full story of what really happened. And it had an agenda which I found a little bit unusual. For example, you know, the film focuses on the Israeli participation in nonviolent resistance, but ignores the international participants of the nonviolent resistance, the ISM, and what ISM has done in Budrus and other places. It also does not focus or does not even mention the extreme violence that the occupiers, the colonizers, have done in Budrus, including the hero of the film, Iyad Murrar, a friend of mine, who was actually injured during nonviolent demonstrations. And you would think that this fact should be mentioned in the film, and he could even show the injury to his shoulder. And yet the producers chose not to show this. They also chose to present the Israeli version of why the wall is necessary, supposedly for security, but they did not present the Palestinian and the human rights organizations' perspectives on this, that the wall is not about security, that it's about land grab. And this, as we explained earlier, discussed earlier, is very well documented, available to anybody to look at. So I think it did not present a complete picture. It was still a decent picture, but it's not a complete picture, and people should get the complete picture.
Yeah, it was, for me, I mean, although it did focus on this man's story and the bravery of this young woman, his daughter, I felt that it was almost like a sensationalist response to something that the Western media could not ignore anymore. And on their terms, they've presented this quote-unquote new phenomena of Palestinian nonviolent resistance, which, as you had described for us, is nothing new, and it's been going on for decades. What I would like to focus on now is your vision. In your book, which is quite fortunate, you lay out, let me just formulate my question here for a second. Yeah, you lay out a vision for historic Palestine, which many have said echoes Gandhi and Martin Luther King, and indeed makes your book a document of hope and empowerment. Would you please tell us what are the demands of people that you are with on the struggle, and what is your vision?
Well, from the time of the first Zionist colony in Palestine, 1880, we must understand what was the goal of the political Zionist project.
Mm-hmm.
The goal was to transform Palestine from a country that included people of various religions and various backgrounds, cultures and ethnicities, to be this homogeneous Jewish state, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this was rejected by the natives, who were 98% not Jewish. And so this is what we have rejected. We have rejected the idea of a racist entity in the middle of us that controls our land without us basically being involved. So what did we call for as a positive alternative? The positive alternative has always been, for the past 130 years, a multicultural, multi-religious society that is secular, that's pluralistic, that has a democracy, rather than this racist apartheid system.
Mm-hmm.
This is what Palestinians have called for invariably, and most of our people have called for it, with very little aberrations. And I would say the Oslo Accords were the aberration, because the PLO and the leadership of Yasser Arafat decided to push for this, or to accept the notion of two states. 78% would be an Israeli Jewish state, and the 22% that remain would be a Palestinian state. But of course, under some aspect of international law that respects the rights of refugees to return to their homes and lands. This acceptance was actually unusual in anti-colonial histories. But in any case, it happened, and I cannot change the past. What is remarkable is that the colonial entities, the Zionist Project and Israel, rejected this and basically killed the two-state solution. There's no two-state solution now, because there are 500,000 Israeli Jewish settlers, even in the small part of Palestine, which we call the West Bank, of course, with Gaza.
They actually expedited their colonization during
Yes,
Oslo.
Indeed. They expanded their colonization. They increased their ethnic cleansing. And I think we see that now, at this stage in our history, in the 21st century, everybody has a consensus that the Zionist project in Palestine is failing and will continue to fail, and that eventually the original idea of all the Palestinians, supported, by the way, with internationals and also even with many Israeli Jews who support us in our struggle for liberation, for human rights, for democracy, one person, one vote, as happened in South Africa.
Yeah, and that brings me actually to one more idea, which is, I mean, obviously, we've talked about how Israel finds any kind of resistance that Palestinians engage in as illegal, violent or not, and tries to punish Palestinians and internationals severely. However, the repression is not limited to the West Bank. The big battle is actually inside of Israel, where this concept of a racist regime that is not based on plurality, on respecting all religions and human rights for everyone, this is where our battle is. And various Palestinians Palestinians at the forefront of the struggle that is exposing Israel's racist regimes, such as Sadat and Mahoul and Azmi Bashara, have been targeted and imprisoned. And I don't know if you want to comment a little bit on the struggle within Israel.
Well, I mean, the struggle is throughout historic Palestine. Yeah. Since 1967, we have had a de facto one state, which is
exactly.
the Israeli colonial state from the River Jordan to the Mediterranean. The struggle has always been about the nature of the state. Is it going to continue to exist as a racist state, as it did from 1967 forward as a joint state,
mm-hmm.
or is it going to become a democratic state? And that involves the struggle of the people within the so-called Green Line, which has disappeared since 1967, or outside the Green Line in the areas of the West Bank and Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
Apartheid is throughout the area. I mean, when we are talking about within the Green Line, for example, 65 unrecognized villages.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, Al-Araqib, was demolished 18 times.
Yes.
The last time was just a few weeks
mm-hmm.
ago. You know, when they demolish a village and the villagers rebuild and on and on. All of these things suggest that the struggle against apartheid is universal and is not limited to a particular geographic area of historic Palestine. And we will certainly continue the struggle, and the struggle of Palestinians who have Israeli nominal citizenship is part of the struggle, and certainly what Azmi Bashara and Mahoul and others have been subjected to is an indication of how racist the system within the state of Israel is, even among Palestinians, a small, tiny minority that remained after the ethnic cleansing of 1948.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and also we would like to point out that in the recent past, I've noticed an acceleration of issuing of racist laws to sort of solidify this Jewish nature in this part of Israel, within the Green Line. But this is not really limited to the Israeli army or government. Recently, I just read recently that there was a Facebook page calling for a Palestinian third intifada, which was vehemently attacked by the ADL here in the U.S. as a page inciting terrorism. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the role of the ADL and AIPAC and other pro-Israel groups in the USA and their role in suppressing information, installing a just solution, silencing people, you know, about Israel. This front
well,
of
these, groups are doing the tasks that are assigned to them
mm-hmm.
By their paymasters, and clearly they do not have jobs if they do not incite and they do not create hatred. I personally call the ADL the Arab Defamation League because
mm-hmm.
that's, for the past few decades, that seems to be their primary and main responsibility is to defame other people, create this unnecessary fear among the American public about Islam and about Arabs and about terrorism,
mm-hmm.
etc., without dealing with the underlying and the largest terrorist entity in the world being the Israeli army
mm-hmm.
and the Israeli state. This is the reality that faces humanity, and increasingly those groups are feeling more and more desperate and besieged, because obviously the truth is seeping out and
mm-hmm.
it becomes very obvious, as we talked about in the previous part of this show. You know, when you have 1,400 Palestinians killed in Gaza in a period of 3 weeks, most of them civilians,
mm-hmm.
including 400 children, and 13 Israelis, 8 of them soldiers, many of them by friendly fire, so to speak, in the same period, this illustrates something that you cannot hide. It is impossible to hide the truth with all these verbal acrobatics
mm-hmm.
About what's going on. And I think this is what it is. And so what they try to do now is, of course, shoot the messenger.
Mm-hmm.
So by shooting at these Facebook pages or even at me, they have a webpage. ADL has a webpage on me, calling me anti-Semite. When in reality, they are the ones who are anti-Semites.
Mm-hmm.
Their hatred of Arabs, their hatred of people who speak Semitic languages, and their hatred also of Jews who speak out for justice and human rights.
Mm-hmm.
They call them self-hating Jews. This is the hate that they are promoting because they want to promote a political idea, which is political Zionism, an idea who's really hung around far too long, and it is time to bury it once and for all.
Yeah, we have our own versions of ADL here in the Boston area. I don't know if our listeners are familiar with the Camera Project and the David Project. They basically perform the same function as the ADL. Let's talk a little bit about boycott and divestment and sanctions, BDS. Palestinians have called for BDS as one of the paths or avenues available for citizens of conscience who believe in the struggle for justice to effect change. And Israel has waged a war against BDS, calling it anti-Semitic. In fact, just recently, the IDF now has created a special unit, so the army itself, not just like the government Hezbollah. The army has a unit to monitor BDS activities abroad. And millions of dollars are being poured into Israeli PR campaigns, especially in the USA. And according to a proposal in the Knesset of recent, Israelis would face harsh punitive measures for BDS actions. And there's this controversial bill calls for imposing sanctions on foreign nationals and groups and on states that give boycott force of law. There's a U.S. law also that stipulates that it is illegal for American companies to boycott a friendly country with a focus on Israel, basically. This whole bill basically is a bill for Israel. I see all of this as a sign that the BDS campaign is actually ultimately an effective tool in resisting Israeli hegemony. Why would they pour so much effort and create IDF units and pour all this money into it? What is your outlook on BDS and the future for a global campaign of isolating Israel until it complies with international human rights laws?
Yes, when governments fail, the people must act. And we Palestinians, just like the people of South Africa under apartheid, called on the international community to join us in nonviolent struggle against an apartheid system. And the best way internationals, of course, can join is by engaging in boycotts, divestments, and sanctions activities. That involves, of course, education, media work, etc. This is part of the reason, as you pointed out, that the colonizers, occupiers, get panicky about these movements because they help mobilize a large segment of the communities around the world to help in a just cause by a nonviolent method. And so they try to suppress these movements. All Palestinian civil society organizations have supported this. And now, of course, hundreds and thousands of unions and churches and others have joined the struggle. Recently, also, there was a Palestine Kairos document issued by Palestinian Christians saying that we support these kinds of activities. This has become very, very well received, and now in churches around the world there are movements to start to work for human rights and justice or to increase their work for human rights and justice. I am very, very optimistic that this movement is on the right track, and not only on the right track, it has accomplished in the past 5 years more than what the similar movement with apartheid South Africa had accomplished over 30 years, from the 1950s to the 1980s. So I think, and that's thanks to the internet, by the way. So again, I am very optimistic. I am 100% confident that we are going to achieve our goal of liberation and an end to this racist system and a democratic state for all its citizens, Jews, Christians, and Muslims.
I'm curious, Mazen, Dr. Khumsiyeh, about academic boycott. It seems like a lot of our local activists buy into a lot of different facets of boycott, but somehow put the brakes on academic boycott. And, you know, for example, you yourself has been targeted as an academic in your own university, and many Palestinian professors have been suffering campaigns of academic persecution, you know, not getting their tenure, etc. And moreover, Moreover, people in Palestine, and especially Gaza, are not allowed to go and pursue, their university degrees or to go out and talk in public in public forums around the world. And yet, people see difficulty in accepting "quote unquote" the academic boycott. What do you have to say about that?
Well, we have to first realize that the Israeli state, the Israeli system, is integrated, and that all the universities in Israel are partners, full partners, mm-hmm. and complicit in the colonization occupation activities of the state. In fact, many of these universities are built on stolen Palestinian land.
Mm-hmm.
For example, parts of Tel Aviv University and Haifa and Hebrew University and others. And that these universities give preference to Israeli military personnel, support war criminals, basically, and support war crimes. Many of the faculty have even failed to even rhetorically mention support for liberation or for human rights for Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly these universities in Israel are a part and parcel of the system in a similar way that to the universities in South Africa were part and parcel of the apartheid system. And when the West and North America finally came around as a people to oppose apartheid in South Africa, they engaged in total boycott, including cultural boycotts, academic boycotts, etc. So that's an important point to make. And the second point that I think is equally important is that we have to remember the reason we're doing this. The reason we're doing it is a nonviolent method to convince the Israelis to change their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And if we have business as usual with Israelis who are part of the system, how are they going to change their behavior?
Mm-hmm.
In South Africa, the white South Africans were forced, the elites who were able to travel to Europe and North America, they were forced to go back and look in the eyes of South Africans only when the West and Europe and America decided to turn their back on that system. That's when they faced back and started to negotiate with the African National Congress and others.
Mm-hmm. I think it was at the University of Johannesburg that recently was the first university to cut all ties with Israeli Ben-Gurion. I might be getting the facts wrong, but it was very significant that it was a university in South Africa that has officially cut all the ties with the university in Israel, and we hope that many will follow suit. We have a little bit of time, and I wanted to focus a little bit on our internal affairs. There's an unfortunate fact, which is that the Palestinian National Authority has been involved in suppressing some of the Palestinian nonviolent and rights to demonstration, reacting to civilian peaceful gatherings, for example, in solidarity with the people of Tunisia and Egypt. The PNA's security forces have been trained by the CIA operatives and by Israel. What can you tell us about this shameful collaboration, and to what purpose does the Palestinian leadership engage in such actions of suppression?
Well, I think the Oslo Accords were intended to do that, and if one reads Oslo II Accord, they will find that the description of the duties,
mm-hmm.
if you want, of the Palestinian Authority, and we should put authority in quotes, since
yes.
there's really no authority other
Elections
than
are way overdue, authority. Yeah.
But the duties of this entity created in the West Bank and Gaza is to stop Palestinians from resistance, whether violent or nonviolent resistance. This is, in essence, the main duty of this authority and for which it is funded. So clearly this is what happened over the past 18 years, mm-hmm. is that the Palestinian Authority, or now we have two authorities, of course, in the West Bank and in Gaza, are intended to stop resistance and to contain resistance and to serve as to alleviate the cost of the occupation by relegating some duties that normally occupiers do in an occupied area to some local people to do them as front men for this operation. This is in essence what had happened, and unfortunately it is happening today. I myself seen it in the West Bank, and my friends in Gaza have seen it, also with the Hamas leadership in Gaza. Even when we tried to go out to demonstrate our solidarity with the Egyptian people a few weeks ago, the authorities prevented us, or tried to prevent us. Of course, I think nothing prevents people when they're determined to do something, and we are moving on, and eventually the power of the people will win. So I'm not too concerned about this issue in the long run. History cannot be stopped. No matter these maneuvers, and I am very confident that we will arrive at our goal.
In terms of the morale in Palestine today, Dr. Khumsiya, and what people are calling for, I see a lot of stuff on the internet calling for the revival of the Palestinian Liberation Organization as a representative of Palestinians all over the world, not just in the West Bank, of dismantling the Palestinian National Authority, quote-unquote, as you say. Where are we now? What do we have to look forward to? Where are we? Also, I mean, in the few minutes that we have remaining, we're seeing a lot of change in the Arab world. Is there? Are you hopeful? Where, you know, what is? Where is your head now about where we are?
Well, I think definitely we are in a stage of human history where people are going to gain power, and authorities, no matter who they are, dictators, colonizers, occupiers, empires, if you want, are going to disintegrate and go to the dustbin of history. This is the time for people to show backbone, and indeed they are showing around the world, from Morocco to Tunisia to Egypt to Bahrain and Yemen, and certainly in Palestine, which remains the center of the Arab world, center both physically and also, by the way, in terms of the attention of the Arab world. But I think it's also the center of the history of people. I mean, I think peace in Jerusalem, peace in the Holy Land or Palestine, will be critical to peace in other parts of the world, like Afghanistan, Iraq, other places. And I am 100% confident that we, the people, as we assert our voice and weaken the hegemony of these militarized forces in the world, we will gain our liberation. It will be a win-win situation for all people in the earth. We in America especially need to stop funding this colonial occupation, the last remaining colonial occupation that that is active as we speak in ethnically cleansing people, as we mentioned with the villages that are being destroyed as we speak. This is enough, and I think the world is not putting up with it anymore. So I am certainly optimistic in this direction.
And you make us optimistic by your steadfastness and your words, and I really encourage people to look up Dr. Khumsiya's latest book, Popular Resistance in Palestine, History of Hope and Empowerment. It's by Pluto Press. It's a fascinating book, according to the reviews, which synthesizes data from hundreds of original records and sources with a comprehensive study of civil resistance in Palestine. It's an inspiring book for anyone with compelling stories about human dignity and resilience, and hopefully will guide us all, people of all religions and all backgrounds, towards a better future for peace and justice. Dr. Khumsiya, thank you very much for being with us today. I would like to, before signing off, remind also our listeners that Dr. Khumsiya will be speaking in two other venues under the heading of Winds of Change talks. One of them happened yesterday, as I mentioned, and there's one on March 30th from 4 to 6 p.m. in Northeastern University, and then 7 to 9 p.m. That was 4 to 6, and then 7 to 9 p.m. in the St. Paul's Episcopal Church in East Central Street in Natick. And I think Stan is probably going to reiterate those two. Are you, Stan? I think so.
One of them.
Stan will give you more details about one of them. Dr. Khumsiya, it's always a pleasure. And I hope when the time is right and we have one state that you will run for president.
Thank you very much. I'm not a politician.
I know you're not.
Your
but
listeners and you to come visit us in Palestine and work with us. We have an event July 8 to 16 where we hope to bring 1,000 internationals to Palestine and work with 1,000 Palestinians to affect change, peace building on the ground.
Can you tell us just a little bit more? So this is July 8th through the 16th. Which organization is hosting?
About 15 Palestinian non-governmental organizations issued the invitation to the international community to come to Palestine. Mm-hmm. The website for that is palestinejn.org for Palestine Justice Network.
Very good. Thank you so much, Dr. Kompsia, and
thank you.
All the best on all the work you do, and hope to be talking to you very soon.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you to our listeners and WZBC, Truth and Justice Radio. My email address is selma.abuayash@gmail.com. Send us your comments and feedback. That's it for us today. Meantime, whisper, talk, or scream, but do not remain silent. Have a great day. Until next time, take good care of our world and of yourselves.
إلى بلد